My name is Brad Price. I want to welcome you to this Bible study on Revelation chapter 17, verses 1 through 6. We have our normal two other teachers with us, Ivy Connor, Bonnie Woodruff. In just a moment, I'm going to be reading our text as we typically do before class. And then after that, we're going to have an introduction. We're going to ask Ivy to introduce the text in a way which he believes is best. Then we'll ask Bonnie to do the same. And then I'll share a little bit of quoted material from a commentary by the name of Keister. We also want to break Revelation chapter 17 down into about four parts. Revelation 17, 1 and 2, we'll follow our introductions. Then we'll look at Revelation 17, 3 individually, Revelation 17, 4 individually, and then we'll look at Revelation chapter 17, verses 5 and 6, and that will close out this study. Looking now at the text, John said, "And there came one of the seven angels that had the seven bowls, and spake with me, saying, Come hither, I will show thee the judgment of the great harlot that sitteth upon many waters, with whom the kings of the earth committed fornication, and they that dwell in the earth were made drunken with the wine of her fornication. And he carried me away in the spirit into a wilderness, and I saw a woman sitting upon a scarlet colored beast, full of names of blasphemy, having seven heads and ten horns." Now verses 4 through 6. "And the woman was arrayed in purple and scarlet, and decked with gold and precious stone and pearls, having in her hand a golden cup full of abominations, even the unclean things of her fornication. And upon her forehead a name written, Mystery, Babylon the Great, the mother of the harlots, and of the abominations of the earth." And now verse 6. "And I saw the woman drunken with the blood of the saints, and with the blood of the martyrs of Jesus. And when I saw her, I wondered with a great wonder." That's our reading. Now we're going to ask Ivy to deal with some introductory material that he believes is best.
We want to go to Revelation 1, 1 through 3, just to get back to the whole idea of what we're doing this for and what it's about. He focuses on the apocalypse, the revealing of Jesus Christ. The title of the book is The Revelation of Jesus Christ. Now, I mean, that's the first line, at least, which God gave unto him to show to the servants which things must shortly come to pass. And he sent and signified it, its symbols, it's signified, its symbols, not literal, by his angel unto his servant John, who bare record of the word of God and of the testimony of Jesus Christ and of all the things which he saw. Blessed is he that reads and they that hear the words of this prophecy and keep the things which are written therein, for the time is at hand. The Spanish Bible translates that the time is pronto. Pronto, you may not know tanto, but pronto we pretty much know means right away. And I believe that it means what it says, that the book is written in a way that is about things shortly to come to pass. And he says the time is at hand. Not that they're going to happen real fast, and they may, you know, we'll see. But that's the jumping off place here. Now, chapters 1 through 11 introduce to Jesus the seven churches of Asia, and the things that were going to happen there to these churches, the problems they had, the instruction that Jesus gives each one of the seven, and their future. He says, if you don't repent, if you're fallen or backslidden, he says, I'll take your candlestick or your lampstand away. Your light will go out. And unfortunately, through history, we know that all those lights have gone out. They've been extinguished. Jesus has come and collected all of those, and the lights no longer burn in any of those cities of the New Testament church, at least as it was founded to start with. And that's a sad thing. So you go through chapters 1 through 3, he talks to the churches, he tells them what they're doing well and what they're not doing well, what they need to work on, not to be lukewarm, not to leave their first love, but stay in love with Jesus. And that it's a wonderful three chapters. You could preach for 6 months just on those three churches, what the problem was, what the solution was, and what our lessons from them take. That's three lessons on each. That's 21 lessons right there. And I've done that before, and it makes a good series. Then you go to chapter 4 and 5. You want to see heaven. Don't look to chapter 20, 21, and 22. I think we'll all agree with that. Don't look there. That's not where it is. The city four square, the heavens with pearly gates and golden streets, never said that. It never said that it was heaven. It never said it had pearly gates. It never said it had golden streets. It said it had gates of pearl, and this wall that the pearls are in are 144 cubits. That's 216 foot wall, high or wide, either way you cut it. That's a big pearl to go in that. That's symbolism. He tells you, as we read, these things are to signify what we're showing here. So it's interesting to see as we go that the golden streets weren't golden streets. It was a street of gold. It's not heaven. It's a huge area. It says in Revelation chapter 20, 21, he says, this is the church, this is the bride. And it closes out, finishing chapter 22. I'll make a remark, and I haven't discussed this with these men, but there are two people at the Dallas Theological Seminary that where all of this millennialism comes from, that make a statement in their books that the church after the chapter three, we don't hear the church anymore. After chapter three, it's not about the church. It's about the impending kingdom and all of that business. Well, you know, it is about the kingdom. Kingdom is the church. Church is the kingdom in the regard of Revelation. But he ends up talking to the bride. I could read. I may not be very smart. I read chapter 22, says the spirit of the bride say, come. That's the church, folks. And the church was represented as the bride in chapter 20, 21, 22. It's there. So we're not talking about heaven when we get there. So if you want to see heaven, look at chapter 4 and 5. That's the throne scene. All the things around the throne, the angels and the four living creatures, the lamb, the lion, the one on the throne, all of these things are there. We discussed all of that. All right. We come to chapter 11. It finishes the first chapter, 11 chapters. That's the first half of the book. And the second half of the book approaches it differently. You have a practical worldview where it's the church fighting the Romans in the first 11 chapters. In chapter 12 through 22, the focus changes to Christ versus the Satan. The Satan is behind this Roman Empire, the evil enemy, and that God is and Christ are helping lead the church in this great battle of Armageddon and the things that are coming down. So that's where I make that delineation. In chapter 14 and verse 8, where we get to our present discussion in chapter 17 today, we learn something about Babylon. Now, Babylon has been gone for 400 or 500 years from the face of history. We don't know where it was. We couldn't find it. They have since unearthed Babylon. We know about it now and where it was and all of that. But Babylon was already gone in history. But symbolically, whoever the enemy is designated as Babylon, the mother of harlots, and as the old Jerusalem base talking about, and as a harlot, or a whore, as we're going to find out in our study tonight. But 14:8. The message comes out before we know anything about Babylon. Babylon is fallen. Fallen, fallen is Babylon the Great. Babylon is fallen. We don't know anything about it. She's not fallen yet in the book, and we don't know who she is, but it's identified, and God tells us who Babylon is in Revelation 17. And we're going to get to that. May not get to it tonight, but we're going to get there. So that's sort of my look at what we have there as we unearth this and look at it. So I will take my turn and stab at this in Revelation chapter 17, and we will look at the two verses here that we decided we would do this way, and I think it's a great way to do it. And we appreciate you listeners and viewers out there. Hang with us, because it really is going to get exciting, more exciting from here on down. Chapter 17. All right, I got a new Bible here, so we'll open it up. And it says, there came one of the seven angels, which had the seven vials, and talked with me, the seven bowls of wrath. He said unto me, come hither, I will show thee the judgment. The book of Revelation is a book of judgment. It's a revelation of Jesus Christ, but he's coming in judgment. And judgment is the key throughout the book. He says, come hither, I will show unto thee the judgment of the great whore. That's the word the King James uses. I don't like the word whore. I don't use the word whore. I don't do it. In teaching the Bible, that's the word here. The word is meant to jangle us and jar us a little bit. It kind of wakes up a whore. We see nice ladies and not so nice ladies, but a whore? I don't think that's good language for us in common ordinary terms. Our harlot is softened a little bit in the other passages, but I will show unto thee the judgment of the great whore that sits upon many waters. The many waters, I think, we'll find out among the nations. She's over the nations, controlling the nations, with whom the king of the earth have committed fornication. There has been intercourse. There has been relationship here with the nations of the world represented by kings, that this whore, Babylon, has affected. And if we're right that is Rome, and we will get to that as we get into the book, if that's Rome, then this whore has been influenced by as Rome among all the nations to traffic, commit merchandise and idolatry and all kinds of immorality with them, as it left the way of Christ, or never was really in the way of Christ. And so that's what I see there. With whom the kings of the earth have committed fornication, and the inhabitants of the earth have been made drunk with the wine of her fornication. You talk about people being drunk on power, drunk on drugs, well, drunk on this immorality of the enemy here is where he opens up chapter 17. And this is an exciting chapter. Chapter 18 goes into more detail. 17 and 18, we know Babylon is gone, but we don't know how, when, why. But it 17 and 18 go now, and it takes it bit by bit, piece by bit, and takes it apart, piece by piece, showing the destruction of Babylon symbolically.
All right, Lonnie, we'll turn things over to you if you want to give your introduction and then go through verses 1 and 2.
Okay. Thanks, Brad. Just one comment, and I know if you've followed this that you understand this by now, that there are a lot of different ways of looking at this book. Ivy's presented one way, and I'm presenting a different way, or in most cases. But I think the thing that we must remember about this is that Brad and Ivy and I believe the Bible identically. I'm sure there might be some little nuances here and there that we might disagree on, but we believe the Bible, the plan of salvation, and we agree on it totally. Amen. So what we are doing here is trying to figure out and trying to learn how to interpret the book of Revelation. And this book has been interpreted in so many ways. And so as you study this, if you follow Ivy's way, you need to listen to what Ivy says in each of these videos and see if that is something that you agree with. If you think that you like the way I'm presenting it, then you study and try to pick those things out and see how that sounds. And so we're not here to make a total determination on anybody. We're trying to present some ideas that we have on the book of Revelation. And Ivy and I both have taught it for years and years. So we're just trying to do the best we can. Mm-hmm. And chapter 17 is one of those chapters that is a real, I don't know if it's difficult chapter, but it's really hard to take in what it says. And so I think as we study this chapter, let's just be aware and think back in history as what has been. If you followed what I've been saying about this, you'll understand that I believe that this revelation is a revelation of the Christian dispensation. I believe it tells us about things that affect the church all during the Christian dispensation. This is exactly what the prophecies in the Old Testament were all about. If you take the prophet Daniel, for instance, Daniel prophesied concerning things that were going to take place that affected the nation of Israel. Now, why do we historically know anything about Babylon, Greece, and Persia in the Old Testament? It's not because the Lord was trying to tell us something about Persia. The Lord was explaining how that nation would affect Israel. And that's the way that Revelation is written. There are a lot of things in here, and people who try to do futuristic views, the problem they have is not understanding that concept. Revelation is written about the church, and it tells about things that will affect the church during the Christian dispensation. Some of them are very repetitive. The four horses are very repetitive throughout the Christian dispensation. But then there are times when things are possibly a little more direct, and I think chapter 17 is one of those. So I'm going to get into the chapter now. And as we look at verse 1 in chapter 17, as Ivy pointed out, he says he's going to show us the judgment of the great harlot who sits on many waters. Now, as we start talking about Revelation, we have to understand we're dealing with symbology. So the harlot is symbolic of something. All right, so it becomes our duty, I guess, to try to figure out exactly, excuse me, had a little problem with a cold this week, so I'll do my best. So we have to, first of all, define a harlot. A harlot is one who is untrue to her husband, or one that is untrue to a man in a physical way. Now, Revelation deals with spiritual events, spiritual things. So what we have here is a spiritual harlot. One, and that would simply be something or someone who is untrue to one God. So a harlot, a physical harlot, is untrue to one man, and a spiritual harlot would be someone who is untrue to one God. Okay, so let's first notice who this harlot is. In verse 18 of chapter 17, it says, "And the woman whom you saw is that great city which reigns over the kings of the earth." So we have a spiritual harlot here who is reigning over the kings of the earth. Now, how in the world could that possibly be? But as we think through this, I think it'll become very clear. So how would a spiritual harlot seduce and control the kings of the world through her harlotries? Well, Ivy mentioned Revelation 14:8, and says, "And another angel followed, saying, Babylon has fallen, has fallen, the great city, because she has made all nations to drink of the wine of the wrath of her fornication." Now, so what we have here is a spiritual harlot, a harlot that is untrue to God. In other words, they teach spiritual things that are not in line with the teaching of God. So if you'll look down again then at verse 17, "Then he said to me, the waters which you saw where the harlot sits are peoples, multitudes, nations, and tongues." So this harlot is pictured in sitting on many waters. Well, that's defined. It's the people of the world. She's ruling the people of the world. Now, let's look a little deeper into that. In Jeremiah 3:9 says, "So it came to pass through her casual harlotry that she defiled the land and committed adultery with stones and trees." Now, the stones and trees are idols. The people in the Old Testament time were committing a spiritual adultery against God by worshiping idols. So what we have here then in this chapter is an example of spiritual harlotry, idolatry of whatever way it might be, but it's turning away from the one God. Let's read Ezekiel 23:30. Says, "I will do these things to you because you have gone as a harlot after the Gentiles, but you have become defiled by their idols." So what we're seeing here is a picture of a spiritual harlot, one that has left God, turned to her own ways, and is worshiping something other than God. That is a spiritual harlot. So that is so important that we understand what that is. And then in 17:2, with whom the kings of the earth have committed fornication, and the inhabitants of the earth were made drunk with the wine of her fornication. So what we have is, as we'll see in verse 3, we have a picture of this woman riding the beast. Now, we have been talking about the beast several times in several chapters, but we have a woman, a spiritual harlot, who is riding or being supported by the beast. Well, the beast in every situation that we've talked about, it's good to define these things, but it takes a long time to go back and redo it. The beast have been those governmental powers of this world that have controlled the people. Now what we have is a picture of a spiritual harlot who is being upheld by the governments of the world. Now, if you'll just think about it a little bit, what's the relationship between governmental powers and religious powers today? Why do we have laws in our country that's based largely, or have been for many years, based largely on the teachings of the Bible? Because it's a Christian nation, or there are a lot of Christians in this nation. It's hard to understand where we are now. Amen. But at the time, these people, in order to, for the government to control these people or rule these people, they have to do it according to the beliefs, the religious beliefs of this, the people in this nation. Now, if you look at other nations and other religions, you'll find out that the nations are largely controlled by whatever religious group is in power in that nation. So what we have here is a spiritual harlot, one who has turned from God to worship other things. And she is being supported by the governments of the world. And as we read down through this chapter, we're going to see how that story plays out and how it affects the church as we go on down through the time in the Christian dispensation. And I just make one more point. Says that she was, the inhabitants of the earth were made drunk with the wine of her fornication. There was so much of it. And they drank so much, it just almost like drinking enough of it to be drunk with it. So we're talking about false religions. And I'll bring that back up as we go on when it comes to my turn to go through the next verses. Okay, I'll turn it back to you, Brad.
All right, thank you. I know we're spending a lot of time, in fact, probably about half of tonight's class as far as introductory material, but it's really important. 17 really begins to shake things up. In fact, Ivy made a good distinction as far as chapters 1 through 11 and then seeing, at least in some respects, a break there. Think about what you find in Revelation chapter 12. Remember the woman? A woman was used to picture God's people. You have the second woman here, but in the first woman, Revelation chapter 12, she is pursued. She is chased. God's people, they're fleeing into the wilderness. That's the image there. But now as you get over here to Revelation chapter 17, you read about this second woman and what's true for her. She's happily riding on this seven-headed monster, and she's drinking the blood of the saints, Revelation 17 and verse 6. I've often said in looking and teaching the book of Revelation that John is a writer who often gives contrast, just as we would think first, last, right, left, black, white. John fills his writings with that kind of thing, and you see that with these two women. I'm going to go back to that quote that I promised earlier. In practical terms, the message is that Christians may find themselves in difficult straits, like the woman who flees to the wilderness outside the social mainstream. But the other option is to cozy up with a debauched prostitute and her pet beast. Readers might find that life outside the social mainstream is not that bad. But John did not make such sharp contrast because the distinction between good and evil was obvious to his readers. For many, the problem is precisely the opposite. John castigates those who seem unable to discern the difference between the true God and the surrogate gods, or to distinguish faithfulness from unfaithfulness. Christians at Sardis and Laodicea had been lulled into complacency by the wealth. We saw that back in Revelation chapter 3, while the people at Pergamum and Thyatira were willing to accommodate the harlotry of pagan practices in the interest of social harmony, Revelation chapter 2. The portrayal of the harlot is designed to unmask the seductive powers that dull the reader's perceptions, startling them into a keener awareness of what faith means. Now, that's a little more complicated language than we normally use in this study, but basically that blends together what Ivy and Lonnie, at least part of what they were both saying. The commentator goes on to say that if people can be persuaded to think that what appears impressive is actually ridiculous, that what seems glamorous is really garish, and that what which appears desirable is in fact ludicrous, they will be more ready to resist it. Now, I like that quote. I think that that is an excellent point, and maybe that helps what explain what John is talking about here in Revelation chapter 17, as he describes this truly strange, somewhat scary, and it's a beast that offers a very wild ride. Ivy rightly pointed out that we're talking about judgment in this chapter. John makes that very clear in the opening verse. And as you look at Revelation chapter 17, you've got 18 verses, which talks about Jesus. He's involved in the conquest as far as the oppressors, the persecutors of his people. And then in Revelation chapter 18, you've got judgment on evil commercialism. You've got the economic, the material nature of this kingdom that we're talking about that opposed Christians. And then after all that, you get to the hallelujahs in Revelation chapter 19, and that shows victory over the enemies. And Ivy understands the victory over ancient Rome. Lonnie has a longer view, whichever view you find to be more compelling. Again, the point is the same in the sense that ultimately they all come out to the same point. John was told to come. He was told to come and see the judgment that God had prepared. And it's interesting, if you go back and look carefully at Revelation chapter 13 and verse 12, and also Revelation chapter 14 and verse 8, the Bible says that this evil power that we're looking at, Revelation 13, we've got the beast. In about the first 10 or 11 verses, it is the beast of evil civil authority. Then beginning in Revelation 13, about verse 12 and following, you have the evil beast of false religion. In Revelation 13, 12, and again in 14, 8, the Bible says that these beasts, they made the people, they compelled the people. They did their very best to force the people to comply with the false religion. Now, I don't know that that was true for every single person. There were surely some people who said, sure, I'll pinch a little incense to Caesar. I'll say that Caesar's God. No problem for me. I don't really believe in any kind of God. But there were some others, especially Christians, that the government tried to force or compel them. There were Christians who were not willing to do that. We saw that back in Revelation chapter 6 and verse 10. They lost their lives. They were crying out, God, how long? Well, now God begins to answer that question. The evil that was associated with this false religion, we've already seen the word whore, King James translation, prostitute, harlot will be some other renderings. This evil was intoxicating. People were enthused about it. A lot of people think that false religion is harmless. The book of Revelation says that's false. The book of Revelation says that false religion, especially what we're talking about, is not only dangerous, it's deadly. John talks about, and this has already been touched on in Revelation chapter 17, this great harlot sits on many waters. That is, there was great influence. There was great authority over many people. You see that a little later in the chapter in Revelation chapter 17 and verse 15. And this wicked power portrayed by a woman stands in contrast to the woman that we read back about in Revelation chapter 12, verses 13 and 17. And again, it builds upon and amplifies the evil beast that we have back there. In fact, both evil beasts in Revelation chapter 13. John talks about this evil power here in Revelation chapter 17 as with the kings of the earth. And he talks about this woman, false religion, sitting on this beast. And Lonnie did a good job as far as connecting that. I believe we're going to see this again in Revelation chapter 19 and verse 20, two chapters later. And then in the following chapter, Revelation chapter 20 and verse 10. But you have the power of religion, which is very powerful, very influential, and the power of evil civil government blending together, coming together, working together. And when you join those two things together and they are both evil, bad things are going to happen, especially for those who are going to try to serve God. When you think about ancient times, certainly Rome was a problem in this area, the emperor worship that was required by people. And John says that this power was the mother of all harlots. It's like she spawned babies. There were other consequences from this. It just kept going and going and going. This evil religion spread and spread and spread. And again, going back to that quote that I gave you earlier, if people can be persuaded to think that what appears impressive is actually ridiculous, then what seems glamorous is actually garish. What seems desirable is in fact ludicrous. They will be more ready to resist it. Sometimes God's people just need a good shaking. The Hebrew writer did that in the book of Hebrews. Christians were tempted to go back to Moses, the Old Testament law, and he uses the word better. He says, look, think, reason correctly. That does not make sense to go back to Moses and the sacrifices. Jesus died one time, and he's the perfect sacrifice for sin. Lonnie got a little bit into this. I don't know that he gave us a couple of references here that I'm going to use. But when you look at a female prostitute to describe false religion, this is one more example of John reaching back into the Old Testament, pulling out imagery from there and using that imagery to communicate important spiritual truths in the book of Revelation. You could go back to Jeremiah chapter 3, verses 8 and 9. Jeremiah condemned Judah for their sins, and he used the image of a female harlot there to describe her wrongs. You could also compare Jeremiah chapter 2 and verse 20. Isaiah talked about the once faithful city of Jerusalem, and he says it became a harlot. That's in Isaiah chapter 2 and verse 1. Ancient Tyre, we read about them sometimes in the Bible, and Isaiah chapter 23 verses 16 and 17 associates them with the same imagery. Even Nineveh. Nahum chapter 3 and verse 4. If you go back and you look at some information as far as ancient Rome, you find that they were infamous for many, many harlots. So here you have God's people. Ivy talked about this. They are compared to a bride. They are pure. They are white. Paul uses that imagery in Ephesians chapter 5 to talk about the church. The church is definitely in the book of Revelation after chapter 3. And on the other hand, in contrast to the bride, you have this woman who is living the epitome of heathenism and just complete ungodliness. And there is this strong contrast, as well as the judgment that we have in this chapter. All right, Ivy, let's have you look at verse 3, then we'll have Lonnie look at verse 3, and then I'll go through it, and then we'll pick up with verse 4, please.
For all nations have drunk of the wine of the wrath of her fornication, and the kings of the earth have committed fornication with her, and the merchants of the earth are waxed rich through the abundance of her delicacies.
I think we want 17:3.
Oh, I got 18:3. I'm sorry.
That's what it sounded like. Yeah.
All right. So he carried me away in the spirit into the wilderness, and I saw a woman sit upon a scarlet colored beast full of names of blasphemy, having 7 heads and 10 horns. We all make mistakes, and I do. And I heard something from Lonnie I've never heard before. I've taught this in dozens and dozens of places around the country. Never has been brought up. And a lot of what we hear in Revelation is manufactured. We manufacture a 1,000-year reign of Christ on the earth. It never talks about a 1,000 reign of Christ on the earth. It talks about our reign with him in heaven before the throne in Revelation 20, but it doesn't talk about it being on earth. And he reigns forever. Revelation 11, 15, we already looked at that. Jesus reigns forever. And so the 1,000-year reign of Christ is a bogus thing. We reign with him for 1,000 years. That means a complete reign, and that we'll get into that in chapter 20. But back to what Lonnie's done, and I say this kindly, kindly as I know, but this thing about the harlot being having a husband is totally not here. I mean, that's manufactured out of thin air. I've never heard. In fact, I made the point because I read something about this last week, not in regard to what Lonnie said, but that there's never no indication this woman was an adulterer. She was a harlot, a whore, a prostitute. No one knows that she's been married. No indication that she was. And that's how we get started. And then so she's, you know, going away from God and forsaking him. No. That's not it. She's an evil prostitute. There's no goodness or no sisterly, was a sister in Christ or anything like that in this scenario, in this thing. So I was just amazed that here we got this harlot that had been married and left her husband, been unfaithful. And that was a scenario Lonnie can come back and reply to that. And I hope he will. But I was just taken aback with that. And again, I read the wrong verse, so hey, that's okay. You know, we do step in things and make mistakes once in a while, but I just, you know, that deserves some attention. So anyway, in 17:3, he goes away in the spirit into the wilderness. And, there, he says he saw this woman upon this red beast, the one that we've seen before, full of names of blasphemy. Nothing good about this beast, having 7 heads and 10 horns. 7 is a complete number. Head is authority. 10 horns. Horns are power. I don't mean honk, honk, like honking your horn. It's talking horns you push with like a bull or an oxen. And, so if you have 10 horns, that's the number of, completeness on the earth. This beast had earthly power, and the 7 heads had authority on his head, and that authority is going to be taken away. So that's my look at verse 3. It's a short verse.
Okay. Lonnie, some things that you want to say about verse 3?
Okay. First of all, just to comment on what Ivy said, first of all, I'm just simply trying to define a spiritual harlot. And you define things in the Revelation by simply going and looking at the physical aspect of it. And the physical aspect is a woman who is untrue to one man. That is a physical harlot, one who is untrue to God, who has been with God, whether they are or not. Specifically at that time, they become a harlot when they leave God. And that's true. And Brad brought up some really good scriptures there. Jerusalem was called a harlot. Well, why would he call his own city a harlot? Well, simply because they had left him and started worshiping idols in the Gentile nations. So that is a spiritual harlot. So I'm just simply defining what a spiritual harlot is. 17:3 carried me away into the wilderness, spirit in the wilderness, and I saw a woman sitting on a scarlet colored beast. Now, what we're looking at here in this chapter is the relationship between the harlot, the spiritual harlot, and the beast. The beast represents the governmental powers of this world, and the spiritual harlot is the one who teaches false doctrine against God and believes and teaches and worships other things other than God. So you have a relationship here. You have a relationship between the governments of this world supporting the harlot. Now, the wilderness, I don't want to take too much time on that, but that can be a little bit interesting. The children of Israel traveled in a wilderness, a physical wilderness in the Old Testament times. Today, the church is traveling in a spiritual wilderness. We are surrounded by sin, and we are traveling through that spiritual wilderness today until Christ comes again. But I'll not pursue that any further but it is an interesting study. And so the beast has 7 heads and 10 horns, and he is carrying this spiritual harlot. And I'm going to go ahead and blow Ivy's mind a little bit more here, and I'm going to define those. And we can, as we go through, we can watch that. We're told that there would be a falling away. That people would, once the apostolic period was over, that people would fall away from God. That is a spiritual harlot, one who falls away from God. The governmental power of the world when Jesus was on earth was Rome. Rome fell, and all during that period of time, there was a gaining of spiritual power by the Latin church, and the Roman government was supporting this Latin church. And today we call it Catholicism. So Catholicism, or the Latin church, was riding the beast. The beast was supporting her. The beast made her. And then when the beast fell, that particular entity of the Latin church became the Holy Roman Empire, which again later on united with the Roman Empire to rule the world for many years. And the harlot, or the false teachings of this world, were supported again by the Roman government. So all you have to do to understand that is just simply go back and look at history. And so I'll wait till my turn on verse 4. Go ahead.
Okay. We have, as we look at Revelation chapter 17 and verse 3, the pronoun he. You can trace that back. Sometimes people like to draw a line in the Bible, draw circles around words. The he goes back to the angel and introduced in verse 1. Notice that John says he, or this angel, carried him away. I find that interesting because the word translated carried is also used in Luke chapter 16. It's been a while since you've looked at Luke chapter 16. It is a place where Jesus talked about two guys, rich man and a poor man. The poor man was named Lazarus. Lazarus was carried by angels to Abraham's bosom. Now here is, and I never connected that until this week, but it is the same word. Lazarus was carried, John was carried. So don't know that we can say a whole lot more about that, but it is definitely something that gets my attention as far as a fascinating point. When you look at the word, which is translated carried here, Luke chapter 16, 22 as well, but especially for here, it means to lead away forcibly. That's the definition. So not quite sure why the angel did it that way with John, but that's apparently what was done. John was in the spirit. We've seen that expression before, Revelation chapter 1 and verse 10, Revelation chapter 4 and verse 2, and he was carried away into the wilderness. As Lonnie said, you can kind of get down into the weeds on that, but here's a suggestion that I'm going to toss out about that. We read about the wilderness back in Revelation chapter 12 and verse 6. Here in the context of Revelation chapter 17, we're reading about these two beasts, the evil power. And my thinking is that John is carried away, if you will, to the center of the power center. He's taken to headquarters, so to speak. John, let me show you just how bad. Let me show you just how awful. Let me show you how powerful this beast really is. And John apparently got a close-up look as far as the power that was harassing and killing God's people. If you do some comparison, and we may or may not do this tonight, I think we probably will for certain in future studies, but if you go back to Revelation chapter 13 and verse 1, and you compare that with Revelation chapter 17 and verse 3, you'll see that there are some definite similarities. In fact, when John talks about the number of heads and he talks about the number of crowns, they match. Same number of heads and crowns in Revelation chapter 13 with this beast that you find back there, or back here in Revelation chapter 17. I want to focus on the color red for just a little bit. There are some commentators who have picked up on that, especially some older commentators, and they have said, aha, red proves, or red's good evidence to indicate that John was talking about the Catholic Church. One older commentator, Wedden, said, scarlet is the color of the popes and especially the cardinals. Well, that very well, I think, has been true over the years, but that's really going too far as far as saying these guys are wearing red, therefore it must be the Catholic Church. Another one, Newton, said the mules and the horses which carry the popes and cardinals are covered with scarlet cloth so that they may be properly said to ride upon a colored beast. Again, I give them an A for creativity, but not much for proper exegesis or good biblical interpretation. In fact, when you start thinking about red in the Bible, this is actually something I covered recently in a sermon. I was always kind of inclined to think that black and sin went together. But as I looked into that a little bit more, that did not turn out to be true in my studies. Black, you can find, for example, the blackness. Jude talked about that. Peter talked about that. The blackness, as far as hell being a place that has blackness, that was the biblical description for that. But if you really want to find a color for sin, it's red or it's scarlet. And you have a couple of references to that in the book of Revelation. You've got Isaiah chapter 1. I believe it's about Isaiah chapter 1 and verse 18, another reference later in the book of Isaiah. And here, it seems to have that same sense. Didn't use black, even though that might be the color that we would use for sin. He used red. Remember Isaiah talked about sins. They would be made white as snow, but they were like crimson. So that is, when you think about the color here, I think another good indication, along with the cup of abominations and all the bad stuff, the names of blasphemy, everything that's kind of a total package here, red was the ideal color to describe sins, wickedness, and abominations. I will make this point as well. This comes from Barclay, his Revelation commentary, Revelation chapter 17, Revelation, volume 2, page 180. Barclay has a lot of issues. I think we would all agree with that, but sometimes he's good on historical information. And he pointed out that the ancient emperors in Rome, they often sought titles, which were essentially the same kind of title that Jesus had. I'm not going to get detailed about the quote. I give you where it is, but they sometimes took titles which meant to be reverenced, or they took a title which meant I'm divine, or they took a title which meant Savior, or they took a title which meant Lord. So when you look at this book, whether you expand it some or whether you limit it to Rome, Rome definitely has to be included as far as what John was describing. So those are the things that I wanted to cover over three. Ivy, let's go back to you and see what you have for verse four.
Well, verse four, I've got this this new Bible here, so let's see what I could do with that. Again, 17:4, and I've turned the page, following some of this down with you. And you want to go ahead and read it, Brad?
Sure. In that fourth verse, John says, I'm going to pull this up, I'm running two computers tonight. And the woman was arrayed in purple and scarlet and decked with gold and precious stone and pearls, having in her hand a golden cup full of abominations, even the unclean things of her fornication.
Yeah, the immorality here is obvious. And the abominations, there's nothing, I don't think that was ever good with this woman. That she came and had a husband and all, again, that's spurious. That's not biblical in that regard. Lonnie's working from a definition that I don't know we have, but maybe we're confusing that with the earth beast who was called the false prophet. Now there's your teacher. This woman didn't teach him anything but sin. I don't see her teaching apostasy or anything there, Lonnie. And so I come back to that because that's a major point of your foundation, and it's just not there. It's like shortly come to pass. It either means that or it means nothing. And if it's in chapter 1 and it's in chapter 22, five times he says, this is going to happen quickly. And 3,000 years, 2,000 years from that time until now is a long time. It's not as shortly, and it goes on beyond that, you say, and that's not what it does. You've got the church going merrily along after Revelation is over in perpetuity on to that, but it doesn't show any fulfillment after that. These things are to shortly come to pass about those seven churches. You got to keep the context. You keep the context and be faithful to that. Then we have something. Otherwise, it just can't be that, or we could make the revelation mean anything if we ignore the guardrails or the parameters or the framing that's done by John here. It's like Ecclesiastes is a book of really philosophy until God is brought in and we fear God to keep his commandments and that type of thing. How the book is written is a look at the judgment of God and Jesus and the victory we have in Jesus and why we have that. And Rome was the issue at that time, the enemy. And, I just think it's important that I take the stand and let it be known that there's no way that I can see this going beyond the basic demise of the first Roman Empire, as we might say, because that would be shortly in the span of time. So, and Lonnie and I have talked about this, and there was some misunderstanding, I think, on both their parts. I'm not a full preterist in going back and trying to make everything fulfilled within 70 AD. I don't believe that, didn't believe that. And so I'm a longer guy out with Rome went away and was destroyed by really their own means. So that's just a little look at that, Brad.
Okay, Lonnie, verse 4, and then after that, I'll say a few things and we'll close it out with 5 and 6.
Okay, the scarlet, first of all, I just need to make mention again, I want to defend my position a little bit here, but if you'll think back in the Old Testament, Jerusalem, the Jewish people, the northern, 10 northern tribes left, and Judah remained, but Jerusalem was God's people. That's where God dwelt. He dwelt in the temple. That's where they went and worshiped God. But yet in Isaiah, he calls them a harlot because they had left God. Now, the same situation exactly prevails in what we're talking about right here. When Jesus was on the earth and the apostles were teaching the truth about the gospel, there were many, many people who became Christians, thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands. As far as we know, the church grew tremendously. But after the apostolic age, they began to fall away. They were once God's people, but they became a harlot because they left God to follow other false teachings. And that's exactly what I'm trying to say. And I think there's biblical evidence for that beyond any comparison. The scarlet, we talked about that. I won't go into that much. The scarlet is a color that is used to represent prostitution and adultery and all kinds of things like that. And most of us have probably heard of the Scarlet Letter, a book that many of us were required to read many, many years ago. And then the color, the meaning of purple is always associated, or mostly is often associated, with royalty or nobility or luxury, power and ambition. So we have a scarlet colored beast, one who has committed prostitution or adultery by falling away from God. And they are seeking royalty, nobility, luxury, power, and everything to go with it. And that's precisely what happened. All you have to do is go back and read the history, because that's precisely what happened at that time, as the people of God began to fall away and they began to form dioceses and things like that and control. And then they finally got to a single person control. And that is adultery. That is spiritual adultery. That is falling away from God. So the meanings of the colors then fit precisely what happened, because the Catholic Church became rich beyond imagination. Look it up on your computers today and see what the total wealth of the Catholic Church is today. You'll be surprised. If you take it all in combination, it is tremendous. And so they gained great wealth, they gained great power, and they did it all as a false religion, as a harlot that had left God. And so that is precisely how I'm trying to come from with that. And I don't think there's anything that's not biblical about it. So if any of you want to challenge that, hey, I'll be glad to hear from you. That'll be fine. All right, I'm going to turn it back to you then.
Okay, a few comments over verse 4, and then we'll turn back to Ivy for verses 5 and 6. When you look at the description here, this woman who's arrayed in purple, scarlet, decked out in gold and precious stone, singular and pearls, you have a description which is not too far off from what Jeremiah described back in Jeremiah chapter 4 and verse 30. That's one more example of reaching back into the Old Testament, perhaps John bringing Old Testament information forward to apply it for his readers. When you look at expensive clothing, people wear expensive clothing for different reasons. Sometimes people wear expensive clothing. They get all decked out, so to speak, especially when we think about women, for seductive purposes. When you think about people, let's take a young male, for instance. If he's going to be seduced, it's probably not going to be from a woman who's 110, all saggy and filled with wrinkles. I mean, it just doesn't work that way. But you have someone who is young, trim, pretty, attractive, dressed up, and there's going to be a definite attraction there for a lot of people. And that was how the false religion presented itself. It presented sin in a very attractive way. The devil is a master at that. Paul talked about, when dealing with the Corinthians, that Satan is like an angel of light. He can make evil, the worst evil, seem like it is good. You find sometimes people saying, well, I deserve this. I should have this. God wants me to be happy. The devil has a lot of different ways to reach people. When you look at how this woman is described, she is arrayed in the finest and the most expensive clothing. I think Lonnie did a good job as far as highlighting that. You have here perhaps a reminder as well, in a general sense. I think this is a good point of application, that when you look at the unsaved, they are after the things of this earth. They want the material things of this earth. Earlier today, I talked to a 19-year-old man, and he said, I want to get rich. I'm always thinking about how to get rich. I want more money. That's all I think about in life. Well, the people that John described did make it big. They had a golden cup. That's how God pictures their wealth. We'll see more about that in Revelation chapter 18 as far as their material prosperity. And again, a golden cup from the outside, it looks so good. But Jesus dealt with that. Luke chapter 11, Matthew chapter 23, when he was talking about the Pharisees. He said, on the outside, it looks great. You look great. People think that you are so religious. People think that you are so spiritual. But inside, you are just full of rottenness. And here, John talks about that with the word unclean. If you have the King James translation, I believe it's going to be rendered filthiness. In some other places, you could look at Matthew 10:1, Matthew 12:43. You're going to find that this word describes demons. Well, if you think dirt is bad, if you think that scum is bad, if you think that things like algae and mold are bad, they're nothing compared to the wickedness, the evilness, the vileness of the devil and his helpers. Paul also used this word as far as the word translated unclean when describing idolatry, 2 Corinthians 6:17, and also sexual sin. We're going to wrap it up now with verses 5 and 6. Try to tie that up in about 6 minutes if we can. And Ivy, let's go back to you.
Upon her forehead was a name written, Mystery, Babylon the Great, the mother of harlots and abominations of the earth. And I saw the woman drunken with the blood of the saints and with the blood of the martyrs of Jesus. And when I saw her, I wondered with great wonder, one version says, and I think that's a good translation. I wondered, I was just amazed at this. It's bad to see a man that's drunk. You see a man that's drunk and totally bereft, maybe throwing up and unkempt and so forth, or the man of distinction that drinks vodka or whatever, he's staggering around, and that's bad. But to see a woman, the beautiful top of God's creation, and Mary, the epitome of that, in bringing us his son drunk, is something that I shudder at. And yet, that's what we have here. And what she drunk on, this is figurative, folks. Don't make any of this stuff literal. It's figurative. He said the woman was drunk with the blood of the saints. All the killing and the death that the Roman Empire had done, millions had been touched by this. And the blood of the martyrs of Jesus, when I saw her, I wondered about this. And think about how this is impacting. So it's very succinct in the introduction, very, very brief, really not a whole lot here. I think that's heavy duty, but folks, stand by, because it's going to get really, really interesting as we finish chapter 17 and go into 18, which is the total destruction of Rome.
All right, Lonnie, to you.
17:5, we're talking about?
5 and 6, uh-huh.
Okay. Folks, I'm going to say this before I start in on these verses. This is one of the most difficult passages in the book of Revelation for me to say what I believe it is. If I were trying to do something other than that, I would, other than interpret what this book is saying, I couldn't bring myself to say it, but I cannot bring myself not to say what I believe this is teaching. And it is very telling about what's going on in this world today. And it is very hard to swallow. And it is something that I think that because of this, it also gives us in the church the emphasis that we need to be teaching, and we need to be teaching the truth. But this verse says, and on her forehead was written, Mystery, Babylon the Great. Babylon in the Old Testament kept God's people physically captive. They were captive. They were slaves in that country of Babylon. Now, what we have here is a name of this woman that's riding the beast, the spiritual harlot. So what we have is Babylon the Great is keeping people spiritually captive. Those who are following her ways are not following the ways of God. And we need to be proclaiming and teaching that in every way we can in order to bring them out, as is mentioned in the next chapter, of that situation. Now, the next verse, or the next statement, the mother of harlots and abominations of the earth. Now, folks, that is a statement that we need to understand. But boy, it's hard in the world that we live in today to accept what this is saying. The mother of harlots. Well, a mother bears children. And harlots came from Babylon the Great.
5 minutes.
And we have Catholicism as being Babylon the Great. And from her was born harlots, and God calls them abominations of the earth. Now, this can be almost pinpointed in time. It is a fairly well accepted date of October 31, 1517, that Martin Luther nailed his 95 theses to the Archbishop of Mainz. He also nailed the document to the door of the Wittenberg Castle Church in Wittenberg, Germany, possibly on that day or shortly thereafter. In this verse in Revelation, we see false religious organizations that were born from this spiritual harlot, and they are also called abominations of the earth. They are harlots and abominations, just as this first spiritual harlot was. As frightening as it may seem, it gives the church an extraordinary understanding of how God views false religion and those who teach false religion, and that we need to be doing something about it in any way we can. So it's a very, very chilling verse to me. And I hope you understand it and see it and understand what it's saying. Then it says, I saw the woman drunk with the blood of saints, with the blood of the martyrs of Jesus. And I saw her and I marveled at great amazement. So this great spiritual harlot has had tremendous, tremendous power and effect upon the spiritual well-being of the people of this earth. That's where she sits. She sits on the waters of the people and nations of this world. And she's still there today, along with a lot of other false religious organizations. So pray about it and work about it.
Okay, thank you. One point that hasn't been addressed yet from Revelation 17, verse 5, is the word name. And upon her forehead, a name written. You probably already know this. We may have touched on this in a previous study, but in the Bible, the idea of name often describes or summarizes what a person or power is like. We do the same thing. When someone says Facebook, well, that means a lot. When someone says heaven, again, we instantly think of several different things. Or someone says hell, a lot of different images come to mind. Or if someone says God, the devil, the same kind of thing. Sometimes it's the name of a company. Growing up, people used to say, hey, Culligan man, there was a commercial about that. Other people, when they hear a restaurant name, maybe good food, bad food, slow service, fast service comes to mind. And here we have that same kind of thing. It is a name. In this case, the name represents all that you can imagine that's bad. Definitely opposition to God's people. Lonnie Ivey has touched on this at different times. This woman should have been ashamed of herself, but as you look at the text, she did not have any shame at all. She's very open. She's willing to have that name in her forehead. I'm not going to get into this, but you do find other references to the forehead in the book of Revelation, sometimes positive, sometimes negative. If you go back and you look at ancient Rome, and this is certainly not the only culture, but ancient Rome is believed supposedly women who were prostitutes had their name tattooed or branded on their forehead. Sometimes people think that they wore some kind of name band. Even today, if you think about people who are involved with prostitution, you know, they have a name and they want people to remember their name so that they can have repeat customers. Some see an allusion here, and I guess this is possible. I don't know that this was John's point, but it could be one more example of him going back to the Old Testament and taking something out, which he applies in the New Testament. When you look at the Old Testament priest, the high priest, holy to Jehovah, was on his forehead. You can read about that starting with Exodus chapter 28 and verse 36. When Christians spoke against this false faith, when Christians spoke or resisted this evil, and again, if you take the view that Lonnie has advanced, that is a long-term view. If you believe that Ivy has a stronger case where John's talking about ancient Rome, but both points are true ultimately, that Christians, when they oppose this kind of stuff, it usually does not end well. Certainly that was the case with Rome. There were a lot of Christians who died. There was a lot of blood shed. And it's no wonder that John used the kind of imagery that he did when he talks about this woman drinking the blood of the saints. One other quick point, then we're going to shut it down tonight. The King James translation says, King James is a great Bible. I studied with it for a number of years. It sent a lot of people to heaven. But the King James says, I wondered with great admiration. Now, if you have the King James translation, realize that John is not saying, hey, this beast is great. No, he's not saying that. The original thought is in no way whatsoever complimentary. John was astonished. He was surprised. Remember, we talked about him going out in the wilderness. It's as if God said, I want to give you a close-up look at the power seat. I want you to understand how pervasive, how powerful, how awesome this force is. And yet, in spite of that, you have to see the contrast between as massive, as powerful, as seemingly overwhelmingly this beast was compared to God's people. Here's Christ sitting in heaven, the Son of God, and the beast, we should say plural, were definitely not a problem for him. Let's pull up Revelation chapter 13 and verse 3. I want to go ahead and close on that note, because back here, notice we have something very similar to that sixth verse in Revelation chapter 17. And I saw one of the heads as though it had been smitten unto death, and his death stroke was healed, and the whole earth wondered after the beast. Now imagine a force so powerful, so incredible, that not only the whole earth would wonder after it, but even the Apostle John would be amazed at the power of the beast. So this is what we have as far as our final study tonight, Revelation 17 and verse 6. Lord willing, the next study will begin with Revelation 17 and verse 7. If you've joined us as far as several of our previous studies, thank you so much. Please continue to tune in. God bless and have a great week.